Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Scott Ritter, and I'm going to get him on the line right now. So bear with me for just 1 second.
Hello.
Hi, Scott. We're on the air right now. So this is Scott Ritter. And Scott, give our listeners a little bit of a background about you and your expertise and what's going on.
Well, I mean, my background is that of a Marine Corps intelligence officer. I was commissioned in 1984 after graduating with a Russian history degree, and I spent a number of years in the Marine Corps. I had the privilege of serving under General Schwarzkopf on his intelligence staff during the Gulf War, where I was involved in, primarily involved in the Scud hunt, hunting down Iraqi mobile missiles. After the war, I went and worked with the United Nations in Iraq for 7 years as a chief weapons inspector, primarily focused on accounting for Iraq's ballistic missile programs. And started in 1998, following my resignation from the United Nations, I've been speaking out about, American foreign policy and in the Middle East, about arms control, about other issues, including, when I was involved in the so-called anti-war movement in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I spoke out on the importance of constitutional due process and on the need for Americans to hold their elected representatives accountable. So I feel like I've been involved in what I would call good citizenship for some time now, namely the absolute requirement for the average American to be informed about the issues of the day and to take action on the empowerment that comes with this information to vote smartly during elections, because that's literally the only chance we have to put our finger on the scale of governance in the United States is to participate in the electoral process and to vote for the candidates that we believe best represents our ideals, our values, our beliefs.
In 2016, when Donald Trump won the presidency, were you surprised?
I was. I have to say that I was not a early supporter of the president, and I can't really say that I was ever a full-fledged supporter of President Trump. I, like many Americans, especially those who served in the military, was aghast when he spoke out and denigrated John McCain's military service, especially that aspect of it, which involved being taken prisoner during the Vietnam War. Again, I'm no fan of John McCain, and there's plenty of territory in which I could be very critical of his record. But the one area that I would never critique would be his service as a prisoner of war, which was honorable in every sense of the word. And to have it attacked by a man like President Trump, or then candidate Trump, who had never served, indeed sought draft deferrals due to alleged bone spurs. I was very much turned off on that. I was turned off on his attack on a Hispanic judge. Saying that because this judge was of Hispanic lineage that he could not adequately carry out his judicial task. That disturbed me greatly. But one thing that disturbed me even more was the way that the Democratic Party anointed Hillary Clinton to be their candidate, as if she had a some sort of birthright to be president of the United States. They ran roughshod over somebody that I was supporting, Bernie Sanders. I felt that how the Democratic Party treated Bernie Sanders was disgusting and despicable and represented a greater threat to American democracy, a greater threat to the concepts of rule by law than any absurdity that might have been uttered by Donald Trump. I still, it wasn't until, say, August or even September that, I began to believe that Donald Trump was going to win the election, that that there was a large segment of the American public that, like me, might otherwise have not rallied around Trump because he doesn't represent, many of the things we stand for or believe in. He's not a politician. He doesn't have a history of legislative action. He's a blusterer, some say a foolish blusterer. But what he was saying resonated with the heartland of America more than anything that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, was saying. People felt abandoned by the Democratic Party, abandoned by the establishment that Hillary Clinton represented, and were looking to Donald Trump with hope that he could somehow deliver on a better promise of what America could be. And at that point in time, I said, I think this guy's going to win it. So on November 16th, or on the night of the election, I was not surprised at all that Donald Trump won.
So from the very beginning, were you shocked? Were you alarmed by what was coming out of the White House?
No, I mean, how could you be? If you were an informed voter who studied the issues and studied the man, nothing he did shocked me because that's what he promised to do. How could we expect that Donald Trump would govern in the same manner as a Barack Obama, as a George W. Bush, as a Bill Clinton? These were polished politicians. These were men who spent their entire lives involved in the political machine, who had deep roots in the establishment, and the establishment supported them. These were men who understood the importance of words when it comes to the establishment and, who carefully couched everything they said. They were politicians, and they had betrayed America by their political actions, meaning that they party over politics and the American working class had suffered. That's what propelled Donald Trump in. I wasn't surprised by anything he said because that's what he promised to do. That's who he was. It doesn't mean that I like it. It doesn't mean that I supported it, but I expected it. A large part of me takes gleeful joy in Donald Trump's dismantling of the establishment. These decade-long programs that have sucked away taxpayer money and in the end just squandered it, wasted it to no benefit of the American working class. Where is this so-called healthcare system that everybody brags about? When confronted with the COVID-19 pandemic, the healthcare system collapses. We've got nothing. Where is this grand, industrial, resilience that we have? We get hit with COVID-19 and we find out that the companies have no reserves, that they're going to collapse. The American worker has no savings. And without trillions of dollars of money injected as stimulus, the whole country would go bankrupt. And this isn't Donald Trump's fault. He inherited this weak house of cards from politicians of both parties who for decades just promulgated, business as usual. And that was the business of putting money in the pockets of politicians and their special interests and not building a country capable of standing up to the harsh reality of a COVID-19 pandemic.
And you said that in 2016, you were alarmed by the fact that Bernie Sanders was treated very badly. In 2020, it was the same story. Wouldn't you agree? And if so, you think there are a lot of disaffected Democrats that might not support Biden in the next few weeks?
Let's never forget that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016. Somewhere around 65, 66 million Americans voted for her. That's a significant number. And I don't believe that too many of that number are, you know, have lost confidence in the Democratic Party to the extent that they aren't going to support Joe Biden. But enough of them who supported Hillary Clinton were, you know, the of the Bernie Sanders wing. And I think they supported Hillary Clinton because they believed that she was genuine in saying, I will, you know, take on the different policy positions of Bernie Sanders. There's not a single Bernie Sanders supporter today that truly believes that Joe Biden is going to take on the policies of Bernie Sanders. I mean, we saw that in the most recent debate where Biden basically, you know, ridiculed Sanders as a socialist. I've beaten the socialist, he said, where he put down, you know, the Green New Deal that Bernie Sanders and others were in favor of. I think that there is a significant element of the Democratic Party who feel betrayed by what's happened here. And, you know, the question is, does that betrayal trump their disgust with Donald Trump? And that's one of the key questions in the upcoming election. Are enough of these Democrats going to stay home and not participate and thereby give Donald Trump's unwavering base the advantage at the polling booth?
You know, Donald Trump had no political experience before 2016, but once he was elected, the Republican establishment kowtowed to him his every whim. Why did these seasoned politicians in the Republican Party give their undying support to Trump, who has no political experience whatsoever?
Well, ultimately, the only political experience you need is to win an election. I mean, that's just the sad truth. And Donald Trump, remember, Donald Trump didn't just prevail in a national election in 2016. That was, the national election was against Hillary Clinton, who I think everybody today can acknowledge was a deeply flawed candidate. Had the Democrats nominated just about anybody else, they would have won the presidency. But they put up the most fundamentally flawed candidate they could possibly pick for the time, and they lost. But before that happened, the Republican establishment put up 16 of its most experienced governors, senators, long-term politicians, and they put them up against Donald Trump in a primary where Trump crushed them. I mean, not just by a little bit, he destroyed all of them, which means that, you know, there was no Republican establishment. Donald Trump emerged from the primary process as the populist leader of, you know, what was left of the Republican Party. There was no alternative. There wasn't, Ted Cruz could have emerged as some sort of powerhouse. He wasn't. He paled in comparison to the popularity of Trump. What we call the Republican Party today is little more than a populist party built on the image of Donald Trump. And these long-term Republican politicians understand that if they don't jump on the Trump bandwagon, they're not going to get elected, because the people that voted for Trump are the ones that they need to have vote for them if they're going to win. So, you know, the Republican establishment disappeared. There is no Republican establishment. There's a loose, coalition of people we formerly called Republicans who do the bidding of Donald Trump, because he pretty much is the only voice that counts in the Republican Party today. That's a sad state of affairs for the Republican Party. I'm not saying this is a good thing. It shows how utterly void of character the Republican Party, has become. And I would dare say that if the Democrats lose this coming election, they'll be exposed as failures for the same reasons, but you know, with the opposite. They couldn't have an individual emerge. The Democratic Party as an institution is corrupt. I mean, how can a bunch of political operatives in the background make the determination that Joe Biden is the one they're going to support, not Bernie Sanders? That means that there's no democratic process in the Democratic Party. So in many ways, it means that the Republican Party is far more democratic with a small d. I mean, because the people propelled Trump against the wishes of the Republican Party, whereas when the people tried to propel somebody like Bernie Sanders against the wishes of the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party came together and crushed them. So I think both parties are broken, and I think we see that in the fact that this election, you don't see too many people saying I'm voting for this person. You hear a lot of people saying I'm voting against this person, and that's never a good thing when it comes to democracy.
So I think, reading stuff and reading what you wrote, that election day, the day after election day, an event like never before. Would you agree?
Let me put it this way. If the polls are right, and I'll right up say I don't believe the polls are right, but if the polls are right and Joe Biden can pull off a 12 to 15 point victory on election night, I think the issue of trouble will be gone. If he can emerge with a landslide victory that cannot be questioned about the issue of paper ballots and things of that nature, I do think we will have a peaceful transition of power from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. I don't believe that's going to happen. I believe that this is going to be an extremely close election, just like 2016 was, one that's going to be won based upon the Electoral College, not the popular vote. And it's going to be extraordinarily contested and controversial. Whoever emerges as the so-called leader on election night will not be declared the victor. I don't think Donald Trump will ever recognize a Joe Biden victory. And you hear Hillary Clinton and others urging Joe Biden never to concede to Donald Trump. So this is an election that's going to be won in the courts. And that's why what's happening today is so important. We've got the opening statement of Judge Amy Barrett, before the Judiciary Committee, and the Republicans are pushing to get her seated on the Supreme Court prior to the election. So if this is a vote, if the national election is going to end up in the courts, that means it's going to end up before the Supreme Court, which means you now have a 6-3 conservative lock. And if they decide in favor of Donald Trump, the Democrats will never respect that, nor should they, to be honest. I believe votes should be decided by the voter, not by courts. But, that's not how the system's going to play out. But then you have Nancy Pelosi, who is saying that she is somehow going to invoke some, bizarre, procedural rules that will put the decision in the hands of the House of Representatives, and she'll emerge as the power broker. Donald Trump will never support that. So we're running into, probably one of the greatest constitutional crises in the history of the United States. And while I'm not predicting outright civil war, meaning we're not going to break into the North and the South, I am saying that this could lead to civil violence on a large scale, because you have, we have some extremely radicalized elements on both sides of the political divide who have already indicated a willingness to go down the path of violence and protest. And if when we're talking about the future of the country, who's going to lead the country, and you have the country divided and unable to come up with a mechanism that guarantees the peaceful transfer of power, the alternative is going to be political politically based violence. I hope I'm wrong. I pray I'm wrong. But unfortunately, that's the direction I see things going right now. The rhetoric is too high. Neither side is willing to compromise. I mean, if you call yourself an American, the only thing you should be saying needs to happen after Election Day is the peaceful transition of power. It doesn't matter who wins. What matters is that we allow for the transfer of power, either to a reelected Trump or to a newly elected Biden. But in any case, our democracy fails the moment we decide that the way to put somebody into power is through violence. We cannot survive as a democracy when we use political violence, and I'm afraid we're heading in that direction.
So you think that 2020 will be worse than the 2000 election?
2000 election was about hanging chads in the state of Florida. It was an election result that, although Democrats were unhappy about, people laugh about today. I mean, I know, you know, some people say they might get an ulcer, but at the end of the day, it was comical. I mean, tragically comical. I mean, to have an election decided by, you know, old men and women staring up at a ballot to determine whether or not determine voter intent by, you know, how deep the indentation was on a piece of cardboard. That's what happened in 2000. Then the Supreme Court got involved about the counting of votes in one state. 2020 is about the entire country. The entire country is divided over, you know, this very polarizing figure, Donald Trump, and this absolutely inadequate challenger, Joe Biden. I mean, 320 million people, and this is the best we can come up with? You know, this buffoon that sits in the White House, or, you know, this 47-year-old corrupt politician that's seeking to replace him? I mean, that's the status. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's also about, you know, other more fundamental issues. I mean, you know, one of the big issues that's torn this country apart is the issue of abortion. And now we have a court that appears to be headed in the direction where it will be, you know, it'll have a conservative majority that, you know, could down the road reverse a fundamental decision like Roe versus Wade. It's about civil rights. You know, we had a horrible summer of racial-based violence in this country. And, you know, that you know, the frustration that exists there is going to bleed over into the post-election angst. It's also about the economy. It's about health care. It's about the survival of the average American. I mean, if you don't have a job and you don't have health care, you're not living very long. And there's a lot of Americans right now that don't have jobs and don't have health care. And the level of desperation that exists in the American body public is far greater than the desperation that existed in 2000. So I think it's night and day. You can't compare what happened in 2000 with what's happening in 2020.
You know, you talk about not having a job in healthcare, but there's one more component that is like the sleeping giant this year, and that's people who don't have jobs and people who have massive student debt. That's going to be terrible.
Well, look, you're talking to somebody. You know, my wife and I put two kids through college, but we had to rely on student loans. And we've done our best to try and absorb those loans, meaning that we're trying not to encumber our daughters with the payment. But it's a scam. I mean, you borrow, let's throw out a hypothetical number. You borrow $40,000 to put your daughters through school. They graduated in 2016. We've paid back $45,000, but we still owe $30,000, and they're going to compound the interest on that. It's never going to end. This is highway robbery, what they've done with education loans. And not every student has parents that are able to step in and burden, take on that burden. We have kids right now that are trying to, make a living out of college, and they've incurred the equivalent of a mortgage with an income incapable of meeting that, and then you put on top of that the demands of health care. I mean, if kids are out there right now, and they're expected to buy a health care plan on a salary that's already been gutted by student loans, so they don't have any money left anyways, then the reality of the cost of living just basically, you still have to rent a place, you still have to eat, and by the time you're done, you have no money left over to afford the absolutely criminal premiums the insurance companies are charging for, healthcare. You can fake yourself. I love it when they say you can buy in, but your deductible is going to be $11,000. That means if I get sick, insurance doesn't kick in until I have 11 grand. Which kid has 11 grand in the bank to pay that? None of them.
Right.
Yeah, healthcare, student loans. When you it just is, as you said, it's one of these things. And the thing that drives me crazy about the student loans is all the money that those kids and their parents are paying goes to goes to Sallie Mae or goes to whomever is running these loan programs. It's not going to the U.S. economy. If you forgave the student loans, all that money that is going to Sallie Mae would go straight into the economy. It's one of the greatest stimulus programs you could actually do by just saying we're going to waive the payments, and now the kids are going to be going out, buying that house, buying the furniture, upgrading their existence, having a quality life. It's not a sin for a young working class American to have a quality of life. I'm not saying having an exorbitant quality, but quality of life. Why do you have to come home from work every day, exhausted, maybe working two jobs, unable to have fun on the weekends, unable to do anything because you have no money? Why can't a kid come home and say, hey, honey, why don't we go out to dinner tonight? Because our paycheck came in, and guess what? We have enough left over where I can take you to a movie, take you to dinner, and we can have a quality of life. You can't do that when you encumber these people with student debt, when you encumber them with no health care, you encumber them with an economy that can't even employ them right now. So, yeah, I think, and this, what we just discussed, is also what's under the radar in this election. We have a population that is already worked up, already frustrated, and it has been taken to the breaking point. And then if we throw on that, the potential for political violence, it can become very widespread. This could be a very bad year, and maybe very bad years coming up for the American people.
Well, Scott, our time is up today, but I would love to resume this conversation at a later date. Would you do that?
Absolutely.
Great. So you've been listening to Scott Ritter. This is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Scott. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you.